Okay, anybody have any questions for Satsang? Is the truth simple or complex? Well, that depends on what you mean by truth. So let me just explain what I mean by that. There are levels of reality, okay? And we call them, those levels are called satyam, the reality. Are we talking about paramartika satyam? That means absolute reality. The absolute reality is Brahman. There's nothing more simple than that because it's non-dual. So it's the absolute simplicity of being because there is, in reality, no second thing. So in that way, it's completely, absolutely simple because it's non-dual. The complexity comes in when we're talking about vyavaharika satyam or pratibhasika satyam. Vyavaharika satyam is the shared reality of science. It's the reality that we can agree upon and analyze, and it's the mathematics, all science, all perception, all of the laws, the order of the universe. So for that, I'd say there's, in a sense, tremendous complexity, an infinite duality. So if that's what you mean by complex, Vyavahara is complex, and I'd say Pratibhasika is complex also because of the manifestation of duality. If that's what you mean by complexity. But in the end, because the Vyavaharika and Pratibhasika, the empirical reality and the subjective reality, are mitya, means they have no independent being of their own, and therefore they have, the only thing they have for their truth is Brahman, we have actually absolute simplicity in terms of what's actually there. But if you're going to be dealing within Maya, then you have complexity, but that complexity with knowledge will resolve itself into absolute simplicity of non-duality. I'm not sure that's what you were talking about or the answer you were looking for, but that's what those words, you know, bring out in me. I guess I mean, is Vedanta essentially simple or complex? Vedanta is essentially absolutely simple because in terms of the truth that it's revealing, since the truth that it's revealing is non-dual, existence being truth itself could not be more simple. In fact, sometimes Swamiji is joked, saying, that is the problem, is that it's so simple that our minds have so much unwinding to do to be able to understand. Because the complexity is mitya. The truth is absolute simplicity in the sense that it's non-dual. Non-dual means there's not a second thing, so there's no two ways to know it. There's no two vantage points, there's no knowing the right side and then the left side or something like that, because non-dual. Does that answer? Does there come a time when you can recognize the self without first identifying the objects in and distinguishing them from the self? Yes, that's a good question. In fact, once the distinction is made and that clarity is there, then you never have to make the distinction again because it's never not there. Right? But you have to see it. And so usually with teaching, you're pointing it out in many, many different ways, because it takes a while for the mind, which does have a lot of complexity and a lot of layers within itself and a lot of emotions, a lot of commitments, a lot of identifications that the self from the standpoint of the mind is continually, the mind is continually finding itself, identifying the self with parts of itself, like with your own moods, for instance, or with your in your relationships, you find yourself totally identified with everything rather than just recognizing the reality of your experience to be that very similar to the reality of your imagination, and yourself as being kind of the adhishtana, the one that's never changing. So it takes some time for the mind to unwind from its habitual ignorance, habitual self-ignorance. It takes some time. That's why in contemplation you see it over and over again, and then you walk out the door and it says that the reeds of the swamp have closed over. In meditation you open it up for a minute and you see it clearly. And then just the force of the world and your own likes and dislikes and attachments onto the world kind of close over what you've seen. That goes on for some time. But definitely there does come a time, not that far in the future either. Even though your mind may be acting out and acting as though it doesn't have any knowledge, it still doesn't cover yourself, even though it's acting like it doesn't know anything sometimes. But you're still there. And you're recognizing that. Your mind also recognizes its own habitual patterns of behavior. They continue to reveal themselves to you, and you continue to pull your mind back home to what you know. You're welcome.
It's with reference to the meditation you did on Thursday, where you were talking about shifting the focus of the mind from its content to it yourself and whatever you bring to the foreground. And the other thing I want to relate to it is the fact that Atma is self-effulgent.
Okay.
So it doesn't need the mind in order to be known.
Yes.
And yet that meditation was focused on an activity of the mind and where its focus was.
Right.
And so I don't know how to ask the question without knowing the answer, but
I can talk around it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm expecting, that it's the only thing you can do. But.
Yeah. You know, on Thursday, for those of you who were in class on Thursday, I did a guided meditation, which actually I'm planning to do a whole series of these just because of the impact of them. I think they're important meditation, and it also touches on the meditation that we just did today. What we were doing is continually and kind of quickly shifting the focus of the mind's attention on whatever thought or feeling or perception was there, and then shifting the mind's focus. So notice how I'm using the mind here. So the mind's focus was on the content of the vritti, whatever you were thinking about or feeling about, thinking about or feeling or whatever, perceiving. Shifting the mind, shifting its focus to me, to the conscious being, to my own self, my own presence. And then going back again. We did it also, we did that shifting with sensory perceptions, where the mind is focusing on whatever it's perceiving, whatever sounds it's hearing, etc. And then shifting to your own presence. And then we did it with the body, letting the mind have its focus on the body, and then go shift its focus to my own presence, and then back again. And then I also asked you to recognize both simultaneously, your own being and whatever you were perceiving, in this case, maybe perhaps the physical body. We also had the mind do the same thing, shifting back and forth with its own thoughts or whatever vritti, thought modification happened to be there, and then shift to your own being, then back to the thought modification, then to your own being. So there's a continual shift of emphasis, shift of focus. And then to ask you to recognize that both are there simultaneously. Okay, so both are there simultaneously because even though the mind is making this shift of focus, and in fact when the mind is kind of shifting its, gently shifting its focus, not trying to negate the other experience of anything external, any external experience or any thought in the mind, it's not trying to negate that, simply shifting its focus. When it shifts its focus, the self, your own being, becomes more dominant in the experience, just because the mind is simply shifting its focus. But in fact, both your own nature, your own self, and the perception, or whatever is filling the thought modification, you know, are there simultaneously. And why that is so is because consciousness, your being, is always present. It's what we call self-evident. The self-experience doesn't even require the mind. It doesn't require the universe. The whole mind, the universe, everything could be an unmanifest condition, and my being still is self-evident me. So the self-evident me is independent of the mind. It doesn't require the mind. But the mind is not independent of me. That's why we say, I am the adhishtana of the mind. I'm what the mind depends on. Because the mind depends on me, my own, the conscious being, my own self, for its sense of being. There aren't two sense of beings. There's only one being, right? So the being, the isness, the amness that the mind enjoys really is only me. There isn't a second one. And the knownness that the mind enjoys is only me, is consciousness. There's not a second knownness there. And so, therefore, I am self-evident, self-shining, no matter what the mind is doing. It's not that I'm a knower. I'm not a knower. I'm just self-evident, conscious being. The universe, imagine this, the whole universe is gone. All duality is gone, all minds are gone, all sense organs are gone, right? The buddhi is gone, right? Any duality is gone, Ishvara is gone, the whole mind, the whole world is gone, and I still am. I am conscious being, but I'm not knowing anything. What am I going to, there's nothing there to know. There's only me. There's no second thing for me to be a knower. I just simply am. I am conscious being, the conscious being which the whole universe enjoys when it's up. That's why in the dream, when you wake up from the dream and that dream universe is gone, nothing has happened. It's kind of an uncanny feeling. It's like uncanny recognition. Absolutely nothing has happened. And all of the knower known relationships that existed within that dream are gone. Right? Now I'll flip into the waking state and probably, unless it's pointed out, won't recognize kind of the just freedom of being that I am, where there is no knower known, there's just conscious being. But now, just put that aside. When when you have a thought, so the mind is active, it has this thought or that thought or this perception, the mind itself is mithya, means it totally depends upon the self-evident consciousness for its being and for its knownness, right? And that self-evident consciousness doesn't require the mind. So whatever thought is there, whatever thought is being illumined, the self just remains exactly the same. Nothing ever happens to it. So it's not that in this making this differentiation, the self is doing anything at all. It's not, and it can't either, okay? And so what's happening is that the mind by but the mind by what it is able to do is change its focus The mind can change its focus to consciousness itself. It can change its focus like a mirror to consciousness, or it can put its focus on a content of the vritti, or even on part of the vritti, or can it change the vritti completely, the thought modification completely? But so all of these changes are taking place, these changes are taking place in a stable me, which is the very adhishtana. So now I'm asking in the meditation for the mind to kind of flip back and forth to recognizing it's the nama rupas, the names and forms of whatever is the content, to the self, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and then sit still and recognize that both the self-evident me is there changelessly, and whatever content is there, the mind can recognize both simultaneously, because the recognition of the nama-rupa, the name and form of the mind, only has for its one knownness the self, right? And so there's no problem. The content of the mind doesn't cover the self in any way. There's not really two things there for you to think, oh, if I'm looking at the self, if I'm looking at the name and form, the self will be gone. There's nothing but the self. When whatever direction you're looking, the self is still there. Right? You can't look outside of the self. Mm-hmm. Like say, you're being yourself and you're, well, let me look in the opposite direction of myself. Okay, but there is no opposite direction because there is nothing else. So you can't escape what is the actual substance in which all subject-object relationships take place. You can't get away from it. And so in the end, I'm having you go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, in order to differentiate your being from the names and forms. Right? Initially, you need that differentiation because there has been no differentiation. So initially, you need that. And then you start recognizing that you know what the self is, you know what the name and form is, and then you start recognizing that the name and form doesn't cover yourself in any way. So that's kind of what we're working for, because actually to really have knowledge, to understand, you have to see that there is no experience that touches or hurts your being in any way. It doesn't really matter what the vritti is. It could be a dukkha vritti, it could be a sorrowful vritti, or an agitated vritti, or a happy vritti, or a ecstatic vritti, or a meditative non-dual vritti. It doesn't make any difference. Nothing is happening to you. The vrittis go on endlessly changing. They're time-bound by their nature. Even if you have a nirvikalpa samadhi vritti, that nirvikalpa samadhi vritti is time-bound. The nirvikalpa self, right, is not. The nirvikalpa means non-dual. There's no... It's the self of the subject and the self of the object. It's in not divisible. So that self isn't subject to any kind of change or modification at all. You know, nothing can touch it. And so one thing that happens is as one starts to gain this knowledge, you're looking for the self experience between the vrittis, or to have a vritti, a thought modification that is a thought modification of the self. But that's all that is the thought modification of the self, and that thought modification will go. The self is not a thought modification. The self is the reality, the conscious being, the changeless conscious being in which all thought modifications take place, which every perception, time and space itself take place in the self, which is itself self-evident. Right? So it's not a vritti. The self doesn't require a vritti, and yet we're looking to have an experience of the self through a vritti.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah. I am the self of every vritti. And so what has to happen in the end is I have to first be able to differentiate this, the changelessness of myself from all of these changing vrittis. Right? And then I have to recognize that these changing vrittis don't cover me at all. It's just like the profound recognition that the pot doesn't cover the clay, the clay pot. It does not cover the clay. It cannot cover the clay. It's not possible. It can't touch the clay. But see how ludicrous it is if I say the pot can't touch the clay, or if I say the clay pervades the pot. We can say all of these things from the standpoint of the pot, but really there's no pot. There's only the clay. And of course the pot can't touch the clay because it's only clay, right? And so no experience that you have, no affect, no mood, no emotion, it doesn't touch you or change you in any way because you're its very being and you're self-evident. Whereas mitya is coming and going and coming and going into that being. So that's what has to be recognized, is that let Bhagavan be. Let Bhagavan just be what Bhagavan is. Let the emotions be, let the life be, you know. Your attachment becomes, the attachment of the mind becomes not this fleeting experience or that fleeting experience, or trying to hang on to this one or that one and not have this one, not have that one, which is impossible, really. You can't win that game. It's not possible. The attachment of the mind comes on that the sanctuary of your own being, the wholeness, the ananda of your own being, and then you can let this incredible manifestation of infinite knowledge, of intelligence, of Ishvara, you know, then you can appreciate it and live out your prarabdha karma and do what is to be done. So Swamiji says, I do my best every moment. That's it. Nothing else. He doesn't worry about anything. He just does his best.
I guess what I want to focus on is this instruction to the mind.
Yeah.
Of changing focus.
Yes.
And just exactly what that involves. I don't have a problem with doing it. I'm just trying to understand.
Well, what is that? The mind is the sat-chit, is the conscious being that it enjoys, right? And then whatever, and the vritti. And so the vritti can, and I always say gently change focus, because I don't want you to think when you're doing that.
It's not like a thing like that.
Yeah, that you're trying to get rid of something.
Right.
You're just trying to notice something that is there to be noticed. And the mind notices it by differentiating itself from it. It's not illumining it. It's differentiating itself from it. Whereas before, it had not noticed it at all, had only taken itself to be it. So now I'm asking it to make a differentiation that it hadn't made before. It had only, whatever thought was there, I am that. Whatever it is, I am that, I am that, I am that, I am that. There's no recognition of a stable self in which these vrittis are coming and going. And so when I ask for that gentle shift of focus, what you start to recognize is that I am changelessly there. No matter what the vrittis do, no matter what the emotions are, no matter what the situations are, nothing is happening to me. And I now start noticing that over and over again. Then I start noticing that, in fact, I don't even need a change of focus. I always am me, exactly the same.
Yeah.
But initially, that drik drisha viveka, we need to be able to differentiate the mitya mind, right, from its changeless adhishtana, which is me. Then when, a lot of times when I do this shift of focus, and I did this on Thursday also, I said, now just be yourself. Remember that? Just be yourself. Because you're shifting focus back and forth to yourself, now just be yourself. That means instead of having the ahankara, the I thought, be identifying with the nama rupa, the names and forms and various experiences, just let that ahankara go and just put the I where it belongs, in me. And I'm not doing anything. I simply am. And I'm not being hurt. Nothing can really hurt me. And my nature is ananda. That's why I say, using words like, if you take away the verbal function of these words, you can say, The nature of myself is absolutely welcoming. It evokes no fear whatsoever. You know, it's welcoming. It's like moths going toward the light. You know, because it's what you seek in life, but it's been projected out. And so once that becomes experientially the truth of that becomes recognized, then the mind wants to be with what it's always been searching for and has discovered as my own being. So that's where the attachment is. And then I can let Ishwara be Ishwara. I can let my prarabdha karma be my prarabdha karma. You know, but let people be as they are, as you say. Give them everybody space to be and be interested in them, not judging them. Be interested in Ishwara. All of the incredible variety of Ishwara. Does that make sense? It does?
Yeah.
So now we're at, Virginia says, the gravity of karma makes it seem as if Vyavahara is more real than Pratibhasaka. Well, you know what? It is more real in relationship to Pratibhasaka, but not in relationship to the self. That's the difference. Like Swamiji will joke and say, you know, this world, the waking state, is a bigger joke. It lasts longer. The dream state and these things, you know, the Pratibhasaka are taking place within the waking state. And so from between the dream state and the waking state, or the Vyavahara and the Pratibhasaka, the Vyavahara is more substantial, but only in relationship to each other. But in relationship to me, there's no difference at all.
In the other ones, you can get consensus about the Vyavahara.
The Vyavahara is a shared reality. Empirical reality is shared reality, and Pratibhasaka is subjective reality. You know? Mm-hmm. And so, between those two, you can say one's more real than the other, but in reality, this mithya, the Vyavaharika mithya, is no less mithya than the Pratibhasaka mithya. Both of them depend upon the self for their adhishtana. So when you're going in that realm, in reference to the self, there's no difference. That's why in the Mandukya Upanishad, Gaudapada spent a lot of time with the dream and showing that the arguments you make to show that the dream is less real than the waking state are false. You know, they're only true in relationship to each other, but they're not true in relationship to what we call paramartika satyam, the absolute reality. Yeah. Does that make sense, Virginia? Anything more you want to ask about that? Okay, Virginia, you say that thought really helps me when I think that things are too heavy. Yeah. They're too heavy because of the type of involvement we have with it. Sometimes you just have to let go and give the whole thing to Ishwara. That's a nice little practice also. So Laura asks, how to distinguish between Ishwara Srishti and Jiva Srishti? Ishwara Srishti is really Vyavaharika, it's the shared reality, where Jiva Srishti is the subjective reality. Even though the subjective reality, the unshared subjective reality, exists and belongs to Ishwara, right? It originates in the Jiva. Srishti means creation. So the little creations, the imaginations, the projections, the thoughts that arise out of the jiva are what we call jiva srishti, even though the jiva, and with all of its capacities to project, etc., are all part of Ishwara. But the thing is, look at it like this. Say, Ishwara srishti would be like the body, mind, sense organs, equipment, right? In the karma also, of the prarabdha karma, of the jiva. But what the jiva does with them, like the jiva is given a mind, that's Ishwara, but that mind is able to create a lot of subjective projections and things like that. that are not shared reality. So those creations, even though all of it is Ishvara, if they're centered within the jiva, then they become jiva srishti. Does that make sense? Wow. Okay, that's a good answer. Laura says, wow. Yeah, it is wow. Okay, so Maitreya says, it seems as if one needs a sharply discriminating mind to gain clarity and knowledge of the more subtle me, self, which is beyond, prior to, pervasive to the mind. Since the self is beyond, prior to, pervasive to the mind, it seems as if one shouldn't need the mind to see it, to see clearly. I'm not sure what you mean by beyond, because you mean maybe, I don't know, let me think about that. Beyond, how is it beyond the mind? It's beyond the mind only in the sense that it's free from the mind, but remember that the self is the self, is the non-dual self of the entire creation. And so from the standpoint of the self, there is no time, there is no space, there is no dimension within, in terms of the create, the time space that exists and dimension that exists within the creation. That's why if I ask you to have an imagination, you provide the space, you provide the time, you provide the dimension, you provide all of the objects. That's all part of the imagination, and that entire imagination exists within the self and cannot get beyond the self. Like, for instance, you know, just to be clear, like say in the rope snake analogy, the snake isn't going to bleed over onto anything other than the rope. The rope is perceived to be a snake, and so the existence of the snake is the rope. The snake has no other existence apart from the rope. So there is nothing in this time-space creation that has any being apart from the self. Now the thing is, you say, it seems as if one needs a sharply discriminating mind to gain clarity and knowledge. So far, so good. Even in the Katha Upanishad, when Yama says that, it's like walking on this viveka, this discrimination is like walking on a razor's edge. And he says that because there is no space at all between reality, between consciousness, and the namarupa. There's no space at all. So it's the most subtle differentiation. You know, so your mind has to be a little bit quiet to be able to notice it. Otherwise it's very busy noticing all of the namarupas, all of the names and forms and activities going on within Maya. It can't slow down to notice, to differentiate itself from its being, right? So that is, it couldn't be more subtle. It's like a razor's edge. Now you say, so I'm going to read that part again. It seems as if one needs a sharply discriminating mind to gain clarity and knowledge of the more subtle me. Now there really is no more subtle me. There's only me. There's not me and a subtle me. So you say the more subtle me, self, which is beyond, prior, pervasive to the mind. It's not beyond the mind. How can it be beyond the mind? Only in the sense that it's not dependent on the mind. The mind is dependent on it. And so in that way, beyond. But not beyond in the sense of time and space. That's where the beyond word doesn't work. It's pervasive to the mind like the pot, the clay is pervasive to the pot. Then you say, since the self is beyond, again, prior to or pervasive to the mind, it seems as if one shouldn't need the mind to see clearly. Well, it doesn't, the self doesn't need the mind or the universe at all, but you say to see clearly. The self is conscious, just conscious being. It's not seeing anything, it's just self-evident. It's its own experience, self-evident conscious being. The mind is the one that has the problem. The mind is the one that's not seen clearly, in the sense that the mind is the one that does not have the self-knowledge yet, until it does, to be able to differentiate itself from the self. Just think about it, where whenever the mind is up, whatever thought is there, the self is there. It never has an experience apart from the self. So why wouldn't it just say, I'm the self? Until somebody holds up a mirror and makes it recognize, differentiate itself from the self, and realize the stability of my own being, and that every vritti, every part of the mind, all of its experiences are coming and going, and I'm staying. So I'm not, it requires me completely, it's totally dependent on me. I'm its adhishtana. But it's coming and going, right? So that's what makes it mitya and me satyam. You know, I'm its truth. Adanya says, self-evident to whom? When we use the word self-evident, it means self-evident to itself, not to someone else. That means that the whole universe can go away, all subject-object relationship can go away, and I'm still self-evident. I'm not dependent. Another way, self-evident means it's not dependent. I'm not dependent on a pramana, on any means of knowledge. I'm not dependent on anything for my own self-experience. So I am self-evident. I don't require the mind. The mind is the one who's suffering from ignorance. I'm not suffering from ignorance. I'm just self-evident consciousness. There's not two things there to be suffering. But the mind needs a pramana. It needs a means of knowledge to give it self-knowledge, which has to do with what we call, the type of self-knowledge is actually called ajnana nivritti, which means the removal of self-ignorance. Because I'm already present. All that has to happen is that self-ignorance has to be removed. Because the self-experience, the self-evident self-experience, is already there. It's just the mind doesn't have knowledge that allows it to differentiate itself and its qualities from the self-experience, which is me, which is Brahman. The mind has to recognize itself as mitya. So Maitreya says, seems like mind is the tool to discriminate satyam, but the mind itself is mitya, so how can it be a tool to discover what is its source? Maybe there's a more clear way to ask. Just because the mind is mitya, you know, doesn't mean it doesn't have a problem. The mitya mind has the problem of the mitya bondage. In the Mandukya Upanishad, it says even the knowledge itself is mitya. Not the object of knowledge, but the knowledge is mitya, the guru is mitya, the sisha is mitya, bondage is mitya, liberation is mitya. Because the self has no problem. It's the what is mitya that is having the problem, but this mitya mind suffers. The suffering is mitya too, but the mitya mind suffers the mitya suffering and would like and feels the mitya bondage and would like to have the mitya liberation. You say it's mitya because in fact the self has never not been liberated, right? So yeah, the tool, so the knowledge too is mitya, yeah, everything is mitya. But the knowledge, the mitya knowledge, can point to this, its adhishtana. The adhishtana is the satyam, you know, which is the sat-chit, the very conscious being of the mitya. So that can be differentiated, pointed to. Sue says, why is there self-ignorance? There's no why in the sense of, why did Bhagawan do this to us? There's no why in that sense, because there's no beginning to, the creation is beginningless, the self is timeless. So there's no answer to a question of why was that done to us or something like that. But if you ask, why is there self-ignorance, then we would answer that like this. If the, then Sue, this might take longer to make really clear. So, but I'm going to give the answer and just know that it's something that we'll probably have to unfold over time. But say, if you recognize that this creation itself that exists, that is something which is something that comes into manifestation and goes out of manifestation from beginningless time, and that its nature is what we call Maya. Maya means that the material cause of the projection of the entire creation has no independent being from its adhishtana, which is the self. Now, from the standpoint of this infinite creation coming into manifestation as Ishvara, means there's no identification with any given part of it, there is no problem. There's a, Swamiji will call this manifestation of the creation, a manifestation of infinite knowledge. Now, what he means by that is if you, right now, if I ask you to imagine a forest, like in the meditation we did, you imagine a forest. Your mind can immediately imagine, you have forest knowledge, your own version of forest knowledge. We can immediately, effortlessly draw on that knowledge, bring that knowledge into manifestation, right? So you're able to do that. Now think of having infinite knowledge and bringing, being able, because you have that infinite knowledge in its causal condition, right? You can bring that into manifestation. That's what we call Ishvara. So Brahman, with the infinite knowledge of Maya in its causal or unmanifest condition, can cyclically come into manifestation. And when, from Ishvara's standpoint, there's no identification with any given part of the creation, the entire creation exists in me. That's why if I say, like, imagine a forest, now that forest immediately comes into manifestation, and the whole forest exists in you, right? It's your being, is the truth of it. So that's this Ishvara situation. But now, think about when the whole infinite creation comes into manifestation, that includes all of the living beings, where we're talking about animals or plants or human beings, whatever. Those living beings have limited minds, limited sense organs. In other words, my body, mind, sense organs exist in one time and one place, and so does yours, and so does yours. And so our body and mind and sense organs, the equipment for knowing, is very limited in reference to the whole creation, right? And so we do not have, as our upadi, as our a conditioning adjunct, an infinite manifestation of knowledge. We're just a little tiny part to the whole. And so this little mind, little tiny mind in terms of size in reference to the whole creation, by the very setup, is going to enjoy self-ignorance, right? Because that mind is located in the physical body, and its experience is limited all the way around. And so it has no means of differentiating itself from limitless conscious being, or recognizing that its truth really is the whole, right? Because that little self is part and parcel of the infinite manifestation, and yet its being is the non-dual conscious Brahman from which that whole infinite manifestation has come. How is it going to know that? So there's a built-in beginningless ignorance because of the nature, the limited nature of the upadhi. And so now, how we say that is, if we're talking about Ishvara, which would be Brahman, the limitless non-dual self, with this Maya, the total Maya, Maya for Ishvara has the capacity to simply project the creation. But for the Jiva, who is part of that projection, that Maya becomes avidya, ignorance, because it has a covering capacity, right? It has a covering capacity because of the limited upadhi. That limited upadhi is not able to appreciate the whole. The whole can't appreciate its own nature as different from the upadhi, and it can't really recognize that actually it is part of an infinite manifestation of knowledge, you know, and that in fact I am Ishvara. It has no means of knowledge to recognize that, and that's just built into the system. And fortunately, there's also built into the system, from the standpoint of the Vedas, Upanishads, there's also a means of knowledge to get you out of this mess once you realize that you're in it and suffering without any way out on your own. No way out on your own. Does that make sense, Sue? I know that there's a lot of stuff in there that we should have to take months to really go through all of that in detail. Michael makes a little note saying, Maitreya's question reminds me of the Mithya tiger story. That story, I'll just tell you quickly what that Mithya tiger story is. As Swamiji tells it, in the Himalayas, there the gathering of some Advaita Vedantins and some Dvaita Vedantins, right? And they were having a debate, and the kind of the chief acharya of the Advaitins, the non-dualists, were having a debate with the chief acharya of the dualists. And so while this debate was going on, a tiger came into their setting, and all of a sudden, both the Dvaitin and the Advaitin jumped up and ran, and both of them climbed up a tree, right, to protect themselves from that. And everybody else scrambled away too, but they were protecting themselves from this tiger. So the Dvaitin said, "Ha! If there was really non-duality, you wouldn't have run up the tree, you know?" And the Advaitin said, "No, not at all. Mithya tiger, mithya running up the tree." Something like that. So different orders of reality.
So there's Dvaitins that call them, who say it's Vedanta also?
Yeah. They're like, there's Dvaita Vedanta, Vishishta Vedanta, and Advaita Vedanta. They're by some sages or whatever you want to call them that came along later. And so they have to be, their position has to be negated. And it has been. Okay, Sue. Anyway, I'm glad that helped for the time being anyway. There's Ramanuja and Madhva. And I forget who's who. I think Madhva is the Vishishta Advaita.
Ramanuja is a Dvaita.
I think so. I tend to get them confused. And also what they say, I have to study every time to teach it because I don't remember. They have their own philosophy. It's not logical, so you can't remember. Yeah.
Is the mind something more than just a collection of thoughts, thought flow? I mean, is that what you call the mind, is all these vrittis and stuff? Or is there a mind that has vrittis? I mean, I don't know what to think about the mind except that there's vrittis.
Well, the mind really is a flow of vrittis, but then the mind is made of sattva, and so it's an actual kind of changing substance in a sense. So it will say, so what they do is they break the, if we look at the mind as something that is continually taking vritti after vritti after vritti. The mind has four types of vrittis that are only for itself. That's the ahankara, the ahankara, the I notion, the buddhi, the decisive thinking, however we want to talk about that. The manas, the emotions, negative emotions, and just thought flow. And then the chitta, memory. But then the mind is also involved in perception. Mm-hmm. Right? And so it's not going to be just a vritti popping up here and a vritti popping up there. Right? It's a matrix of sattva. Yeah. But the sattva is continually changing. Right? So that's another interesting thing. With the sattva, rajas, and tamas, the maya, when we try to get to a first cause of maya, this is in chapter 4 of the Mandukya, this gets into an incredible discussion. Something that itself changes, right, needs to have a karana. But the problem is that the changing substance goes into an infinite regress. And so you can never actually get to the karana, the cause, because every cause itself is an effect. Mm-hmm. Okay? And when that becomes beginningless. When it becomes beginningless, there is no such thing as cause and effect, then it's negated. So you cannot get to the causeless cause. You cannot get to a first cause. So it's always chicken and egg. And so then there's no resolution of this cause-effect duality. So this is a big discussion. Okay, everybody, are we done? It's 9 o'clock. Let's see. All right, everybody, let's call it a night.